This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Eric McNulty, and welcome to Leader ReadyCast. It seems that every bit of information we get today comes with at least one companion bit of mis- or disinformation. This is particularly challenging for leading an emergency response because there's urgency both to assessing the situation and providing assistance. From alleged microchips in vaccines to claims that a weather weapon is directing severe storms, leaders must fight through the fog of fallacies as well as the usual challenge of incomplete and sometimes contradictory information. The prevalence and increased persistence of mis- and disinformation means that every leader needs to be ready for it and prepared to counteract it. It can put additional burdens on already stretched communication teams and, as was seen in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene in North Carolina, may actually result in physical danger for responders. To help us understand the current information environment, my guests for this episode are Philippe Bormans and Justin Snare. Bormans is a crisis and risk communication expert who has worked with the African Union, the World Health Organization, and others. Snare, an alumnus of the NPLI at Harvard, is founder of Signal Solutions and Prepper.ai, the AI for the age of disaster. They both have a lot of expertise to share with us. So Philippe and Justin, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Thank you, Eric, for having me.
Yes, thank you for having me join.
It's really good. I'm looking forward to this conversation very much. And I'm almost unsure of where to start because the examples of mis- and disinformation are coming at us so fast and furious. What do you see as a state of play as we record this late in 2024? And Justin, I'll start with you.
It's both exactly what we've always dealt with and stuff we've never dealt with before. It should be familiar in some ways, but I think the vectors that are going to be attacking us are going to be quite different. As we saw after or during Hurricane Helene, normally government responders and those helping with recovery have a favorable perception in those that are being helped. The misinformation that occurred during that actually, for one of the first times, pointed the finger at those that were providing recovery and support, and it complicated the response and recovery. So that was one of the first times that I think we've seen that. So I think it's not going to come at us the same way. It's going to be more faster, more complicated, and more nefarious.
And Philippe, what are you seeing?
Yeah, Eric, I mean, I agree with Justin. I mean, it's the principles behind that are nothing new. We've always had them. The only thing is now, of course, the speed, the volume, and the impact that they have and can have. At the same time, I do see that it is an issue that is being taken very seriously by not only governments, only also private sector companies, and in situations of emergencies, but also outside of emergencies. So it is on the agenda, which is good because some things never get on the agenda when they deserve to be there. So that is good. And also I can see that when we look at more the solutions aspect, there are many and varied. So I see people coming together, organizations coming together, cross boundaries, cross academic and different sectors. So that gives me a bit of hope.
Can I follow up on that?
Please, Justin, go ahead.
Misinformation, disinformation, and countering it is certainly increasing in conversation. I don't know if the United States is moving along in the direction I think we probably should in regards to preparedness and disasters or public health issues. There's still a lot of conversation and strategy that says point to a trusted messenger, find a champion, have reliable news sources. And I think that old playbook of point at the news or point at someone on a podium may not work. It's assuming that folks will hear that message or see that message. And so I think folks are aware that misinformation is occurring more rapidly or it's more pervasive now. But I think the strategies that some of governments are pushing in the United States are misaligned with the reality.
Yeah, I think it is hard to point at, for example, what you used to say when you pointed a trusted news source, you knew who that was.
Yeah.
Now, there's different sources that are trusted by different segments of the population, and those can be wildly divergent in terms of what they're saying.
Right.
So it gets very tough. So given that environment, what strategies can leaders implement to anticipate the sources, potential sources and types of misinformation during emergencies? And then how can they integrate those strategies into their pre-crisis planning? Because clearly they've got to plan differently for communications. But I think every other aspect as well, because you're talking about incoming as well as outgoing information.
Yeah, I think one of the things is already being very aware of it. And we have a couple of case studies now, and we've seen what it has done during the pandemic and also with hurricane situations and other emergencies. So it's on the agenda. It's even so much on the agenda that in some organizations responsible for emergencies worldwide, it has become a practice. You know, there's concepts of infodemic management, which is specifically about this. So those are the good signs. The other thing is that when you look at a broader solution, one of the big issues is that misinformation, disinformation, and I think it's also good to not look at this as one big issue. Misinformation, disinformation is different. There are different solutions to that, but it is the impact it has on the trust factor. And that in itself is a very fuzzy concept. What is trust in organizations, in governments, in spokespeople, again, but we know it's eroding trust as we all probably understand it. And that is very difficult to fight because it means that the solution is not only about communication. It is much broader. It's about digital literacy. It's about critical thinking. It's very broad. If you go to the tactical level as communicators, crisis and emergency communicators, we have techniques in place, but again, it's bigger than us, so to say.
Also, I think a lot of folks talk about mis and dis, but they also leave out mal often. So mal is true information, but used maliciously to harm. So it's true, but it's opportunistic, right? So, and it could be used at scale. So that could be another problem. So it's mis, dis, mal information.
So perhaps we ought to take a step back here, I think, and just, would you, and maybe one of you pick it, you don't both have to, but do a sort of a one sentence definition for the audience of misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation. That would be, I think, helpful to level set here.
I could take like a high school level attempt at this and then be corrected, but I'll give it a first shot. So misinformation is false or inaccurate information shared without the intent to harm. Disinformation, I think, is deliberately false information spread with intent to deceive or harm. And then malinformation is true information used maliciously to harm or mislead. That would be my way of organizing it.
Yeah, and that is, Justin. I mean, that's how it's defined, right? Is there intent? Is there no intent? And then malinformation is a technique because you have an intent, but you take true information and then put it in a different context and what have you.
Yeah, okay, right. Yep. And each of these could be organic or inorganic, purposeful or not. And that's one of the things I'm seeing a lot is that a lot of the conversations after COVID, especially around the CDC and folks, seemed like they wouldn't account for some of the misinformation or disinformation as being organized. Like it was just organically spread by the population and they were just misinformed. I think in some of these cases, intent is by an actor. And I don't know if we spend enough time in the United States trying to figure out who that actor is, or it may be a distributed actor, but it's not all organic. It's not just people sharing on social media. And so I think leaders need to recognize that there are campaigns of disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation. It's not just a citizen sharing something because they have a poor health literacy, or they, want to share something that will get likes. Like it's not necessarily inorganic. So
it sounds like, I mean, the bad actors, as it were, are getting more sophisticated about this, and therefore, the good actors need to be equally sophisticated or more sophisticated. So, how do you go about monitoring and identifying the emerging misinformation, disinformation, or malinformation? Figure out where it's coming from, and you're in the real time of a crisis, things are moving quickly. How do you actually, are there tools available to help you to navigate that and create a good operating picture?
Well, yeah, there's a bit of an irony in that, because one of the tools, of course, that allows for massive deployment of disinformation, let's call it then specifically with an intent to harm or to you know, to spread that wrongful information with an agenda is artificial intelligence. On the other hand, the tools, the more powerful tools that allow us to do predictive analytics, social network analysis, and that's just looking at stuff and detecting, is also based on AI. So <Yeah. laughs> so it's this technology with like any technology, probably use. Right. I mean, you can use it for good, you can use it for bad, but AI plays a big role also in detecting, analyzing, predicting, and then later on in the second stage, countering disinformation or malinformation as well. So yeah.
Yeah, and also that the next layer to that is like the set it and forget it. So Eric, you said someone about a bad actor. What if the bad actor just set it and released it? So it's not a place that you can go and find it. It just moves around the internet adapting. So it's, we're going to start seeing adaptive cybersecurity threats, or we already are. And so I to say we'll go target a place on Earth or find a hot spot of misinformation when it could be purposefully distributed across the entire social networks, entire countries. So it's, I don't think the old way of looking at it is saying that there's an actor somewhere is enough. It literally could be the weapon of mass misinformation, like a little IED left around. And so it's going to take a new way of considering this. And so there are tools out there, like Philippe said, I think one of our best tools is acknowledging that we can't use the old playbook anymore and start incorporating misinformation, malinformation, disinformation from organic or inorganic sources into our exercises, our plans, assuming that we're going to get a tidal wave of misinformation or disinformation particularly during events. We've already said that concurrent disasters are bad and co-located disasters, a cybersecurity threat during a hurricane. People acknowledge that that's a possibility and it would be devastating. What about misinformation during a hurricane? Purposefully released or released months before and then activated to just sow discontent and confusion during a response like we saw during Hurricane Helene. Mm. So it we have to account for it as a part of the almost every hazard. If there's a hurricane, we should expect misinformation about it now.
Oh yeah, I think from the emergency communications point of view, it should be in there, right? I mean, when I design simulations and you work on that aspect as well, Justin. Although I focus on the comms, on the communications aspect, it is in there. Standard. You cannot think of a simulation or an exercise, or we shouldn't be thinking about organizing an exercise without that aspect in the communications part of the exercise. And we see it happening in every single emergency, and not only in emergencies, right? Like Justin said, there are actors who use this on a very strategic level in a long-term aspect. I wanted to come back as well on potential solutions. It's not only technology, but what I strongly believe in is also that I think I said in the beginning, it's not a one single solution kind of issue. What is very strong is when you see media, civil society, and governments and institutions working together. That is very powerful. But as we said, it needs to be first recognized and on the agenda. But there are cases where we've seen that working, and that is very powerful. But it never goes alone. It's never without also investments in media literacy, investments in policy and regulation. It's a complicated issue which is requiring a lot of independent players and different levels of society to start collaborating.
Yeah, as I was thinking through that, I'm thinking this, you're talking about things happening at different scales at different times, and I agree with you. So assuming it's part of the environment, whatever threat you happen to be addressing is a smart thing to do. But the need for connectivity, as we would say in our meta leadership terms, because I have one expectation of what the CDC and the WHO are capable of doing because they are very large organizations. When I get down to a local health department, they may be having to battle this as well, but with far fewer resources that are already a stretched and probably under-resourced communications team, if they've even got a dedicated communications team. So I think that's going to be one of the real challenges here. The bad actor or actors, whether they drop and run or they are in act being active, they can be small and nimble and do a lot of damage without a lot of resources. And it's harder, I think, for the good folks to respond. It would seem to me here also that perhaps one of our best antidotes and one of the hardest ones these days is building and maintaining trust with the public in advance of, so in the our day-to-day interactions, our day-to-day operations. Building up in the putting deposits into the trust bank to sort of preempt the spread of misinformation, and so if so, you are the trusted source, or at least people go to check against it. How do you think about that level of trust and transparency, and how official how organizations can do that in advance of any adverse incident?
So this will be wildly unpopular, but that's okay. I think we should honestly, I think we should be taking an even further step back and teaching folks to operate in a zero trust. Assume that any bit of information that's coming your way may be misinformation or malinformation, and educate them to be critically to critically think about it. I think that's where we're lacking. You could say, "Trust me, I am the government. I'm here to help. Here's my memo," and they just may not. Like, it could be the most reliable message, and you could spend months trying to build trust with them, and they just may not trust you. So I think we should be starting way earlier, teaching folks that they need to be critically thinking about the sources of information that they encounter. I assume what I see now first is fake. That's my starting point almost always now, until proven otherwise. It's you'll never it's having a government or an official say, "Trust us, here's our memo." You won't even be able to get that message out when it's facing a million messages that look the same, have the same style, that say something different. So it's just going to be a tidal wave. So I think people have to learn how to scrutinize the information more. That's probably dissatisfying to a lot of people, but I think we need to not trust everything. And Philippe, that might be sacrilege from your side, but
No, I mean, Justin, completely agree. I know we're relying on that. Fake by default is also my mindset, but the thing is, we specialize, right? I mean, we are not the average person out in the street. So I mean, first of all, we've got our background and our experience, and we're probably wired like that. But of course, it's not everyone, right? So the education part, the critical thinking part, is definitely what is needed even more than 20, 30, 40 years ago. But we also know it's very, very, very difficult to get back, because we're going back, and that's a big step back. But we need to get back to school, and we need to get back into the curriculum, and we know how difficult that is. But at one point, critical thinking, critical skills, getting that back into into an overall general education will be crucial, because otherwise we're just fighting something that we cannot win. At the same time, the trust aspect, we know that governments are not trusted, or at least, the general trend is to trust private sector companies more than governments. And then it depends on where you are on the globe. But because let's not forget that aspect as well. Misinformation, disinformation, malinformation can easily be deployed globally, easily translated, easily pushed out to different channels. But the relationship that, if we now take a simple example, citizens have with their government is of course different wherever you go in every single country or even region. I mean, I'm based in Europe. We have plus 20 different ways of relating to the government, and that plays a big role as well. So it's going back to also looking at, as a communicator then, and that's my area, so just talking about that, as an emergency or risk or crisis communicator, It's understanding your audiences. It's going back to behavioral insights, capturing those, and not only knowing what they think about the emergency, but also how do they, you know, what's their knowledge, attitude, and perception of the mis- and disinformation landscape. And before you know that, any kind of communication that you do, well, it's just a shot in the dark because you don't know.
Right. From a government perspective or a leadership perspective, you know, when I mean zero trust, I would assume that my message doesn't land, that I have to give it in a different way, different format, different language, faster, basically meet my audience where they're at. And so don't assume that my memo is trusted. Find every way possible to get it out to the audience so they get it. One, they can get through the noise and actually see my message. But also assume whenever misinformation is being spread during an event or something, it's teaching people to ask, who's profiting? What is the motive? Who benefits from chaos here? Who benefits from this message? That's usually what I ask whenever I see something on the news now or on social media, is who is the benefactor for this information? And unfortunately, that takes time. You know, if I see AI right now can produce hundreds of legitimate looking research studies that have fake publications. And unless you go through and search for all these publications, they seem reliable. And so no one has enough time to go through every message they get to say, is this Journal of Environmental whatever real or not? They just believe it at face value. So I think what we're going to have to start doing is finding a way to, part of this is noise. There's so much of it coming at us all the time that we now spend seconds discerning whether something is worthwhile or safe, whether it's an advertisement or a message from government. So I think technology is going to help us with this to filter out noise. There's some efforts out there where it'll be akin to having a chief of staff, an AI chief of staff that's filtering things out, that's doing that legwork for you. This is a fake journal, therefore don't give it to Justin, or flag it as fake. That's the sort of technology I think we're all going to need eventually. There's too much noise on media and messaging. So at a personal,
yeah, I would agree with you that there, I mean, it is a fire hose of noise every day.
Yeah.
And yeah. And unfortunately, we've been talking about media literacy and building critical thinking for decades now without actually having done much about it. So the problem's gotten worse, and I don't think we've made great progress on that particular solution.
Right.
But as you say, it's interesting to start with it's fake, and also I think there again part of what I'm seeing is that there are trusted messengers and/or trusted fact checkers, but it's not one, and it isn't sort of the government. It may be a person within. It's either a local person, you're a school nurse, you're a local health officer, or independent people who build a following on certain social media channels. This is where I think, you know, Philippe, you can comment. It gets very complicated to try and navigate this because you're looking at different platforms and different communities and where are the people, but there are the self-forming communities of scientists in certain areas or the emergency response community in different areas where you have people with enough authority and enough authenticity and transparency who can, I think, step out and still deliver a message, but it's hard to coordinate them when you're talking about multiple communities like that.
Yeah, and that's why the investment in, if you look at health emergencies, the investment in community engagement, that needs to happen all the time, but specifically in what we then call peacetime, you know, when you don't have a pandemic going around the globe. And unfortunately, it's often, I mean, I see a lot of organizations fall back to the standard communications approach, which is, you know, yes, we'll have a statement, we'll have a press conference, we have key messages, blah, blah, blah. But I'm not saying you don't need that, but I'm saying that in the context of infodemic management, which is both on and offline, rumor management, if you want to call it like that, communities play a big role because they have trusted leaders that could be religious leaders, could be, you know, people from civil society organizations. But these have a trust level that in some areas of the globe, the government never can reach. So that is also an interesting aspect. And I think we can find that outside of health emergencies as well. Let's look at the people who have trust. Let's work with them but also, and I think that's another point, in respect of their beliefs. Having worked in different corners of the globe, it is actually possible, and again, that's an example from an health emergency, to work with religious leaders and local representatives without having to go in with your big scientific hat on and white jacket and say, we know better. You can do that while having respect for their local beliefs, natural medicine, medicine influenced by religious beliefs, whatever. But also by collaborating with them, you can dispel other dangerous misinformation or disinformation. But it's working with those communities hand in hand.
Right. Eric, could we go back to the one of your thoughts on the kind of smaller communities of
sure.
information sharing? So that's, I think, a fairly well-known, you know, work with a local champion or find a community partner. There's a digital side of that that also has a long track record, but one that's, I think, changing a bit, where now the internet as a whole, or even entire social media platforms, are becoming so much noise. There's so much that you're having small, basically isolated pockets forming, smaller decentralized networks within larger ones that don't talk to each other, but they become a screen from all of the noise. That now you have a almost a vetted space where you might have someone in there digitally. It could be a Reddit subreddit. It could be a channel. But also you start to get more and more curated information within those networks, and they become separated. These can become silos very quickly, where one group is not getting the correct information or what they believe is not correct information. So I think this like fragmentation of our communications and networks are going to get worse as we realize that the broader internet or broader spaces might actually be just it's just a swamp of information now that we can't sift through. So I think we're going to see more and more smaller digital networks, like the opposite of the World Wide Web. We will have the neighborhood wide web of folks that are sharing information amongst each other. So I wonder how government and leaders will make use of that. Again, another use of AI for this is honing that core message that is accurate. And then how do you adapt that at scale to meet 1,000 different audiences and what their predisposition towards your message is? So adaptation of core messaging at scale using AI, personalizing it to language, belief systems, resistances. Never before would we be able to produce thousands of highly tailored messages down to the individual level. That's been very hard to do before. And so start thinking about that. What's the core message and how do I adapt it to the human metadata? Like the stuff that would make it personalized to them, to make it land, would be another strategy now.
Yeah, I can see that being a particular challenge for, again, large government organizations that are used to we take 10 hours to craft the perfect press release and then drop it to the established outlets and think that's going to be enough. And I know a lot of organizations are thinking much more dynamically than that, but it's still there's still, I think, a lot of emphasis on that single message, let's get it out and through established channels. And now you have to think in a much more guerrilla, sort of guerrilla marketing kind of way.
It's targeted advertisement used for good, right? So it's take everything that we have right now on the internet, our purchasing history, my searching history, where I live, what I've done for work, is all being used to sell me things. Why not use that information to make me highly personalized messages when there's a wildfire? Like, use that. Like, tell me, you know, I go to Hilton, as according to my metadata, send me a message that says, hey, Hilton's accepting people that need shelter. Like, that's not a big leap. It's being done already. It's just being used to sell cans of Pringles instead of safety or better health decisions. So I think we should be making use of the technology that has decades of track record. Just use it for good. At scale with AI, this is already being done in the commercial markets to sell us more stuff. Why don't we adapt that to sell health messaging or disaster messaging?
Yeah, and that from there we go to this example of working with virtual audiences, right? So AI allows us to replicate segments of populations and audiences that we want to communicate with during or before, during or after emergencies, and we can now virtualize those, and so we can actually test our messages, which are based on real human data, but virtualized, and we can test those messages before we actually push them out. Because we also know that if you want to do that on the ground in real, that takes a lot of time, a lot of resources. But now we have a virtualized environment thanks to AI, which allows us to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean A/B testing at scale, at low cost, and then seeing which messages land for particular segments. I mean, that's like I said, that's being used to sell us Pringles. Why don't we use it to sell government services or to help people make healthier decisions? There's a long track record of that being done already. I think the cost of it will be driven down and become more accessible to governments, if they choose to do it.
If they choose to do it.
Yeah, that's the key here. Like this sometimes they delay getting the message out in order to be 100% accurate when saying this is 70% accurate, but acknowledging that there's a space for wrong could have helped more people just being honest, saying this is the best information we have at the time, than being 100% accurate. So like, what's the risk benefit of waiting? So I think we have to have these hard conversations that do we want to get a imperfect but timely message out and acknowledge where it could be wrong versus wait to get the right information out, be 100% correct, but harm people.
Yeah, having had these conversations with government communicators, we're fighting, I mean, what we call speaking in uncertainty. So communicating when you do not have all the facts in the context of a crisis or an emergency, that is fighting against almost 100 years of training of many communicators. It took me several years to get from my PR education, where it was the golden rule, if you don't know all the facts, you don't go out there, to move and to switch completely to being able to speak with uncertainty, but still conveying information that, allows people to help themselves. And so it's hard work, but we need to do that, because otherwise we lose time, and time is that resource that we don't have in emergencies. Yeah.
It also fills the vacuum. Like there is a hole there for people that are looking for information. And if we wait to have perfect information, we're tricking ourselves to think that that hole won't be filled by misinformation, by those motivated to confuse. So getting something into the space and trying to plant a flag saying we have 60% of this information right now and we don't have it all, but we'll get back to you. We're the government, we're here to help, versus saying nothing and letting 100% of that space be occupied by misinformation, and then you've lost. You have the bot-to-bot sharing of the information, the algorithm gets tricked, and then that's the message you see everywhere, is the thing that got into the space first. So I think we're just playing by a different set of rules, Eric, still.
Well, and I think too, as I'm listening to what Philippe was saying about modeling audiences, one of the potential upsides here may be that you can model and show the strategy of what happens if we go with 70% certainty with this message versus waiting to get 100% certainty. And you can model both what you're doing as well as what the bots may do, and show again that you that, because if you're just going in and say, well, I think we ought to go out with this, we're not quite sure yet, people assume you're supposing that, as opposed to being able to actually have a knowledge base behind it. And if you can build the case and said, let me show you what happens when we, what the trade-off is between waiting 6 hours versus going faster, and have people actually see what happens.
And Eric, we can do that, because it is a very important point, right? Because we, I mean, everybody has well, in these kind of big organizations that need to communicate, I mean, there's also this, protect yourself as a professional, right? So, how am I going to explain that my standpoint is we need to communicate with only 60% of the information. How do I defend that? What is the business case? Well, we can do that now. We can quickly apply different theories. I've done that, for instance, with applying game theory to risk communication, and you actually can see the different scenarios play out. What if, what you exactly said, Eric, what if I only have half of the correct information? What if I only have 70? What if this happened? So you can at least map it out and take at least educated decisions based on the information that you have, based on theoretical frameworks that we know work and are valid in our line of work.
It's almost like, Philippe, we need a, you know, there's optimal conditions under which we want a message, and then there's suboptimal, right? So what are the, even if, say, if we had all that data and we could model out how to communicate effectively, there still might be situations where we don't, and we have to decide what is the crisis standards for communicating in this situation. And I don't think we've had enough of that conversation of saying, in the event of an earthquake, if we're not sure if it was an earthquake, it's probably okay to tell people that might have been an earthquake. But that's not, that's a pretty linear hazard, right? It's not complicated. So it's when you get into like Hurricane Helene, where you have hundreds of messages, hundreds of counterpoints, different strategies that have to be communicated. Like, how do you communicate in that, not just in a crisis, but when your communications won't be perfect? Like, what are the standards for crisis comms? And maybe there's a missing corpus of documents. I'm not a crisis communicator. Maybe this isn't a new thought, but I think we need different standards, Eric, where we're willing to do as much good as possible. And maybe I'm just a more pragmatic as I'm getting older, but that's...
I think you're right. I mean, I do think it would be helpful that if there are some of the larger organizations in any space, be it CDC, WHO, FEMA, or whomever, who has the capacity to run some of these scenarios and run tests and come up with some general guidelines that say, here's how you do it most effectively when you've only got what you think is 70% of what you want in terms of information, or 50 or whatever it happens to be. Because again, local organizations will not have the capacity to run those.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Be able to do that.
Yeah. I wonder if that people are able, if you were to put like an uncertainty scale on your messaging, like would that, like, it's like a Philippe, it's like the, when I'm at a deli counter, when I see how much time I have to wait, like knowing how long I'm going to have to wait reassures me, and I don't mind. Yeah. So if I see unreliability rating, like, you know, 30% unreliability, I can use that. You know, I can compare it. But I wonder how most people would feel if they, you know, this is 8 out of 10 positive, right? Reliable. Yeah.
I mean, I know, and I get what we're talking about there, but then I see potential risk as well. But I do think that we need to look at definitely what you've mentioned differently, Justin. We need different frameworks, different crisis or emergency communication frameworks. We've been working with older frameworks, which were very valid, but now we've got polycrisis and permacrisis, and we've got all these things that are shifting around, so we need new models. So that there needs to be attention from both the academic world and the professional world working together and see, you know, what are different models that can take into account that uncertainty and those kind of things. On the percentage model, I think for us it would work. The again, coming back to the average person in the street, we know that risk perception, for instance, is so different depending on where you are, what your background is, even, you know, male, female. I mean, we've got different, and that, I mean, putting that on in a percentage scale would be, I think, difficult. But there are techniques like that, as Justin said, that are being used in the commercial world. If we look at the behavioral sciences behind that, we should be able to translate those in the context of crisis and risk communication and use them as well, in an ethical way and a transparent way. But it would be possible, and we need more work in that area, definitely.
Yeah, and I think too, it there needs to be a greater level of communication of what is taken as acceptable levels of certainty in different spheres. Public health people think about it differently than do emergency managers, than do elected officials. And it's hard because you sort of an assumption you understand what I'm taking as an acceptable level of certainty to be able to tell you something. And if I don't know that, and then there's a variance, that's when mistrust seeps in here.
Right.
But I want to shift gears just a bit here, which is, so once this mis or disinf or malinformation begins to spread, do we yet have best practices to how to counteract it or how to stem it, or is it just once it's out there, buckle up, hold on, and do your best?
Philippe,
No,
I have
yeah, I
not
mean,
heard.
there are a couple of techniques like pre-banking and debanking. But there again, it's very new. They've been tested out in different emergencies. Pre-banking is simply, making sure that the correct information is spread as widely as possible before anything happens. Debanking is, of course, looking at immediately being able to counter that misdisinformation. And there are a couple of techniques in that as well. But if we go back to now the latest research done on that area, scientific research, then it's not all, success rates are not always top. It's not the silver bullet, the perfect solution. So I think one of the things definitely is, first of all, detecting early and on time, and not a lot of organizations spend enough resources in that, I think. And it's not only just doing social and media monitoring, right? It's really going deeper than that. And then it's mapping out your ecosystem. Who are the players, both positive, neutral, and negative? I think you should know that as an organization, as a government. And then bringing the resources to bear when to prepare all that, and then looking at which kind of networks can you set up that your message comes through and can break through the noise, which is very difficult to do. Another thing as well is knowing and understanding and accepting what you can change. If you look at certain conspiracy theories, some organizations have, and I think that is a good decision, just stopped trying to have those people change their mind, because we know from research now as well that in certain types of people who believe in certain conspiracy theories, I mean, it's almost impossible to change the mind. And then you're simply looking at resources during emergencies. Where can we change minds and inform people? And where is it too late? And it's also being able to accept that, which is terrible to say, but that's the reality.
So from my perspective on this strategies, I'd go back a little further. I'd put this into like the preparedness end of or part of the cycle, if it's still a circle. Having more exercises, more conversations about misinformation and malinformation being co-located with all hazards. I would be similar to how we've tried over the past 15 years to have crisis standards of care conversations in the United States. We should be having those same ones now. What's the acceptable message? What are the threat actors? What can we expect? So it's not relying on someone's judgment on the fly to say, get out the message at 60% right. There should be some sort of standard behind it that isn't just one person in an organization. It shouldn't be the public information officer just deciding what's acceptable. So I think we should be going as far back as educating the population, but not as far back in this case, just practicing, having conversations, plans, and having these really, really, really hard conversations around what's acceptable at the time, because we're going to have to move at speed. Like that's a fact. If we're like no one, the adversary is not waiting to say, is my message going to be effective? My counter message going to be effective? Is it true or not true? They don't care. It's a shotgun. They're shooting out messages and they see what lands at scale. If we're waiting to get the perfect one to fight against a million, we're going to lose no matter how finely tuned our message is. So I think we have to find ways to speak faster, to get messaging out faster. And if we're spending 5 minutes debating whether or not the message in nature is a percent not enough percent reliable, we're losing time. So all those conversations need to be happening beforehand.
Well, we've covered a lot of sort of dark and uneven ground here,
We went dark.
because it's a difficult conversation, right? And it's a very fast evolving area. So I want to wrap up with a final question that I ask all of my guests, which is, what gives you hope? And Justin, let me turn to you, and then we'll conclude with Philippe.
I think at least in my profession, with emergency management or preparedness, there's a curiosity that lately that I haven't seen yet, like in the past 20 years. And so there's a curiosity for new technology and new approaches. I think there's a lot more folks questioning status quo now, and the solutions that help them beat status quo are becoming available. So it's not just wishing for it now. There's a lot of cool stuff coming out, new methodologies, new evidence, new tools, new practices that I think leave me pretty optimistic. So it's curiosity, and then I think there's a lot of opportunity right now to make changes if we choose to.
And Philippe, how about you?
I don't know if I'm so hopeful on, like, when we talk about critical thinking and media literacy. As you've also mentioned it, Eric, I mean, we've been talking a lot about that for years and years and years, and I don't see anything changing. So I don't know if I'm optimistic in that area. What gives me hope is when I'm on the ground and I see people working together and community leaders most of the time, and that's also because it's my working environment probably, but when they step up and they use their influence, the trust that they have with their community, and as I said, it can be religious leaders, can be civil society leaders, step up and dispel rumors and misinformation and disinformation, and then concentrate on actually helping people on the ground. At the end of the day, I think it's still that human vibe and that human resilience, I think, that gives me hope. Yeah.
Well, that's good because we need hope in turbulent times, for sure. My guests for this episode have been Philippe Bormans of RiskComms LLC and the Resilience Advisors Network, and Justin Snare of Signal Solutions and Prepper.ai. Thanks to you both. I'm Eric McNulty. Until next time, be ready to lead when it matters most.
This has been another episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter at @HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening, and be ready to lead.